to today's program, titled Protecting Your Trade Secrets in the Pharmaceutical Industry. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Marcus. You may begin.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Let me show you first what our agenda is today. We're going to cover what is a trade secret. Then next, we're going to get into specific examples of trade secrets in the biopharmaceutical industry. We're going to follow up with noteworthy decisions in the pharma industry. And then finally, we'll conclude with best practices for preserving trade secrets, making sure the company is doing everything they can to protect their trade secrets. And then finally, we'll have time for some questions and answers at the conclusion. So our presenters today, I'm Marcus Mintz. I'm a partner in our Chicago office. I'm a member of our trade secrets group, along with my colleague, Justin Beyer, who is also in our Chicago office. And then Dean Finelli and Thomas Hogg are partners of ours in the Washington, D.C. office, who will be presenting as well. So what is a trade secret? What a trade secret is something that courts have struggled with historically. They said, this is one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. That's from the Learning Curve Toys case, which is a federal opinion from here in the Northern District of Illinois. So where do we turn? It's generally the Uniform Trade Secret Act has been the law of the land. It's adopted in 48 states. And there's a bill that is currently pending in Massachusetts that would make it 49. And then New York, which has not adopted the Uniform Trade Secret Act, but does have a body of common law which is substantially identical to the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So what does the Trade Secret Act provide? Well, it provides a uniform definition of what a trade secret is, and it provides criteria for information achieving trade secret status. Further, it defines what is misappropriation of trade secrets and who can be liable for trade secret misappropriation. And perhaps most importantly, it provides for a private cause of action for persons whose trade secrets have been misappropriated. What is the formal definition of trade secret? Under the Uniform Trade Secret Act, it is information, including a formula, pattern, compilation, program, device, method, technique, or process that derives independent economic value, actual potential, from not being generally known to and not being readily ascertainable by proper means by other persons who can obtain economic value from its disclosure or use, and two is the subject of efforts that are reasonable under the circumstances to maintain its secrecy. And so what does that mean? Well, a trade secret is something that is secret. It's not generally known in the industry, and it gives a competitive edge. What this means is it gives economic value to the holder of the trade secrets, either because they're able to use the information to gain an economic advantage, or because they have an economic advantage from that information not being known to its competitors. This is information that cannot be easily reverse engineered by a competitor. Only after significant investment of time, effort, and expense. And just as important, it's kept confidential. The holder of a trade secret must be able to demonstrate that it takes affirmative measures to safeguard the information that it considers trade secrets, and those measures are must be reasonable under the circumstances. So if we're talking about the secret sauce for Coca-Cola, the efforts that are going to be looked at in terms of what does Coke do to keep that product secret, can be different than information that is maybe not as company critical, but nonetheless is important and otherwise satisfies the definition of a trade secret. So in addition to the Uniform Trade Secret Act, as of last year, there is the Defense of Trade Secret Act, the DTSA, which is a federal cause of action that creates a private right of action for misappropriation of trade secrets. The DTSA is substantially the same as the Uniform Trade Secret Act. To apply the DTSA, a holder must show that their products or services are used in or intended for use in interstate or foreign commerce. Particularly in the pharma industry, the DTSA should be broadly applicable. The definition of a trade secret under the DTSA is substantially the same as under the definition of under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. In particular to the pharma industry, it covers scientific information, formulas, methods, techniques, processes, and procedures. And just like with the Uniform Trade Secret Act, the owner must show that they take reasonable measures to keep the information secret and that the owner derives independent economic value from that information being kept secret. So, what is misappropriation under the DTSA? It's an unconsented disclosure or use of a trade secret by one who either used improper means to acquire this secret or at the time of disclosure knew or had reason to know that the trade secret was acquired through improper means and under circumstances giving rise to a duty to maintain the secrecy of the trade secret or derived from or through a person who owed such a duty. As a practical matter, and the definition of misappropriation under the Defense Trade Secret Act is the same as under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. And we'll follow up with specific cases to the pharma industry, but the typical scenario that we see trade secret misappropriation is where an employee or a contractor that's working for the owner takes information that is trade secret information of the company and leaves to either start a competing company or to go to a competitor. The individual that takes that information is guilty of misappropriation, but so too could the employer that hires that person along. And so it's not only is there potential liability for someone who takes trade secrets, but as well when onboarding someone, it's very important for a company to make sure that the person that they're onboarding does not take trade secret information with them from their former employer. Otherwise, that could give rise to liability for misappropriation. So if a company is able to establish misappropriation, what remedies are possible? Both the DTSA and the Uniform Trade Secrets Act provide for injunctive relief, including the recovery of information and the non-use of that information, compensatory damages, and in certain circumstances where an owner can establish willful and malicious misappropriation, they can be entitled to exemplary damages, as well as the recovery of their attorney's fees. Unlike the Uniform Trade Secret Act, the DTSA provides for specific employee protections. And these protections broadly fall under two things. One is whistleblower protection, and the other is legal proceedings. And what the DTSA provides is that individuals are immune from any liability for the disclosure of trade secrets if it's made in connection with a whistleblower action or if it's made in a legal proceeding, provided that the trade secret information is made under seal. In particular to the DTSA, there is a notice requirement where employers are required to include language notifying the employees of immunity under the DTSA for any agreement that's entered into after May 11, 2016. So any new agreements with employees or contractors should contain immunity notice language. So what are the consequences if the immunity language isn't included? It means that the owner of the trade secret that is suing under the DTSA cannot recover attorney's fees or exemplary damages in the event they're able to establish willful and malicious misappropriation. So what information may not be a trade secret? It's publicly available information. It's scratch the surface information. Goes without saying it's information that can be found in publicly available journals, regulatory filings, newspapers, as well as published on the internet or by other means. Particular to the pharma industry, if research results or processes are published in a journal, the information, even if it once was a trade secret, will lose that status as soon as it becomes publicly available. Similarly, business information, plans, threats, that are published in an annual report, like a 10-K filing, or lose their trade secret status as well once they've been published. And so it follows that companies must make sure that they are keeping their trade secret secret. Otherwise, they lose that status. As we mentioned before, what level of security is required? What is a company required to show? Absolute secrecy and heroic measures are not required. It's reasonable measures under the circumstances. However, if a trade secret is leaked, the company must show that they take prompt and reasonable actions under the circumstances to minimize the loss of its trade secrets. And that's something that courts will look to determine whether the information at issue is trade secret. And now we'd like to turn it over to Dean and Thomas, who will discuss specific trade secrets in the biopharmaceutical industry.
Thank you, Marcus. In this section, as Marcus mentioned, we're going to discuss some specific instances in the biopharmaceutical industry of where and when you'd want to potentially apply for or keep things a trade secret. Of the next slide, please. So some examples of information in the pharma industry that may be a trade secret. Of course, there's the balancing test between whether you should file patents or keep things as a trade secret. As Marcus mentioned, regulatory filings or information included in regulatory filings are not available for trade secret protection. So oftentimes the requirements and the information directed to a drug substance or the product because of the FDA regulation and the documents submitted to the FDA, they may not be available for trade secret protection. However, certain processes or development of a lot of the know-how that goes into the development of a new drug, there's where the trade secrets can have very specific and could be very valuable. So, of course, in a pharma and biotech context, the R&D is where the main crux of the trade secret information is going to take place. For example, analysis and research for products in development, testing protocols and results. However, all aside from the obvious, the R&D information that could be protected, there's also information with regard to the business plans and internal opportunities that the company has. For example, market analyses, potential acquisitions that the company or targets that the company is looking at, profitability information, how the company is projecting its profits and where it's looking to increase its profits, as well as personnel information regarding how, for example, to identify subsets of potential patient populations that drugs may be active on. These are all other areas where trade secrets could be available. Oftentimes, as you heard, it's necessary to take affirmative, reasonable measures to keep information secret in order to have trade secret protection. So that said, it should be at the early stage, if possible, especially when companies jointly develop products or if there's a collaboration between a company and academia, it's often a very good idea to discuss at an early stage because of journal articles that are written and posters that are presented at scientific presentations or scientific seminars, what information should be distributed to the public. So with regard to, as I mentioned, going forward with a patent, because of the regulatory filings, oftentimes a formulation or the actual drug product probably makes more sense to have that as protected by patents, whereas as I mentioned, information and know-how that leads up to future developments or lifecycle management opportunities, that could be potential for a trade secret. So the kinds of pharma trade secrets that that potentially could be obtained, R&D groups produce enormous amounts of useful data. All of that know-how that's developed should be kept. Affirmative steps should be taken to keep that information confidential, advise employees at an early stage in their employment contracts about the types of information and the confidentiality that's required of them, especially in early R&D. There's a lot of data on candidates that work and don't work and data that point in a certain direction. Theft could be to directly compete for the race to a drug. It could be indirectly to compete via a separate product in a specific therapeutic area. It could be to apply for a patent under the new race to file system. So development produces a lot of tangible information that is protectable as a trade secret, and it's critical that this information is kept confidential and affirmative steps are taken to advise scientists as well as all employees, including executives, of the confidential nature of this information. Most trade secret misappropriation is of data and formulation and processes, and post-approval misappropriation usually involves certain commercial information, for example, sales data, customer lists, et cetera.
Yeah, so the tried and true path of drug discovery is exemplified here, and along the way, obviously there are different aspects of data and information that is generated that a company will want to keep very closely protected, and what's very interesting, particularly in the preclinical and discovery stage, frequently companies will work with a database of drug candidates, or a peptide database, for example, or sort of a wide range of candidates, which may not be practical to be patented unless you're able to claim particular scientific generic modifications. It's not very practical, obviously, to go through and try to patent. Internationally, for that matter, all of your various candidates. So you want to keep those candidate identities under lock and key. You may want to create a dummy system to name them with give them generic sounding names, and then also the criteria in which you're screening through your database looking for candidates is likely also going to be a lead candidate. Once your lead candidate is out there, or you've selected it, depending on to what extent it's described in other patent applications, as Dean mentioned, you may want to protect your candidate in a patent. So if it's already been described, then certainly, and to the extent that it's not been disclosed in a patent application as to how to best make the candidate going forward. Those are pieces of information that you want to keep highly confidential and make every effort to keep as a trade secret. Post-approval, clearly the documents that you're filing with the FDA are of a highly confidential nature. Ultimately, at some point, they are at risk of being made available to the public after, for example, through freedom of information requests, which I believe you have a certain amount of time to argue against. But you want to, on one hand, make certain assumptions that anything you file with the FDA will likely at some point become available to the public, and certainly after any type of exclusivities expire that you may be able to take advantage of. And so, again, you know, this is just more examples of different types of valuable information that you would want to keep as trade secrets through commercial launch and post-launch. So, particularly with respect to biologics development, I think trade secrets in this context are particularly important. Whereas in the small molecule drug development context, there may be dozens of ways to synthesize a particular small molecule compound. The way and how you formulate that in order to achieve a generic version of a branded drug is generally seen as a straightforward process for the most part. On the biologic side, it's completely different. There, how you make a biologic is almost as important as the substance itself. So, and obviously, protein sequencing is not totally trivial. So the trade secrets associated with a biologic are, for example, in the protein sequence identity, and importantly, which cell lines are being used for production of the biologic, the media conditions that you're using for those cell lines. Isolation protocols for the proteins and storage and delivery conditions are also very important. All of these things have an important and a serious impact on the three-dimensional conformation of the proteins that are being produced and isolated and ultimately delivered. So to the extent that one can keep all of this information highly confidential, and particularly with respect to the type and location of post-translational modifications, and the results of structure function studies and even lot-to-lot variation studies. This is all very, very important information that
is extremely difficult for a biosimilars manufacturer to reverse engineer. So it's, in fact, because of the somewhat longer drug development timelines that are present in biological drug development, frequently you have a situation where the composition patent has expired prior to market entry. So in that case, the other from a branded perspective, the two main items of intellectual property that you may be relying on to keep a great barrier of entry to your competitors is the trade secret nature of how your biologic is being produced, and also you're relying on the 12-year exclusivity that the FDA currently grants first-time biologic BLA applications.
At this point, we'll turn it over to Justin to go through some civil and criminal trade secret cases.
Thanks, Dean and Tom. As we've been focusing a lot at this point on really the true pharmaceutical development aspect of drugs and, you know, various other compounds. And we're going to touch a little bit more on that in this particular section, but I think it's worth noting that while the focus has been on that aspect of it, where the biologics and pharmaceutical industry is not necessarily only in the development stage of it. It's also in the various delivery of those drugs. And so it may be you may be a pharmaceutical compounding facility. You may be a pharmacy itself, and there are still trade secrets that are attached to the work there that may be different slightly from what a trade secret is in the development process. It might be customer lists. It might be the particular medication needs of an individual. It may be the delivery schedule. It may be caregiver type information. And so the reality is that while this presentation is more, it has been more focused on that aspect of it, the reality is that in the definition of what constitutes a trade secret is really left to the articulation of the business, and where the driver is of a business may be slightly different depending on what portion of the supply chain you are in the pharmaceutical process. Over the next several slides, we're going to talk about several different areas in which case law has developed on various places in you know, this process. As Thomas was just talking about, I mean, you have R&D-based misappropriation. You have manufacturing-based misappropriation cases. You have pre-research and development where you're talking about like the vision planning, clinical trial information, and whether trade secret protection can attach to that. How the production methodology can be protectable in a patent context. And then also we're going to talk a bit about some of the case law that's developed in the criminal aspect of trade secret misappropriation cases. As I just mentioned, one of the most litigated aspects of trade secret misappropriation in the pharmaceutical industry tends to be in the research and development area. As most people would expect in this industry, if you are able to acquire trade secrets before a drug is released, you can potentially jump the industry. So there are various concerns, and there are various ways that we'll detail a little bit later on about the best way to protect your trade secrets. But for example, in the University of Colorado versus American Cyanamid case coming out of the Federal Circuit in 2003, prescription drug company had collaborated with various university doctors from the University of Colorado to do some research and development. The doctors performed their tasks. They send the prescription drug company the information, who then turned around and filed a patent application without naming the doctors as co-inventors. Ultimately, the prescription drug company lost the case and had to pay significant amounts of money. Now, that could have been remedied pretty easily by the prescription drug company had they put out in some sort of contract defining who owned the results and what those results were. But in this particular case, the information was deemed to be utilized in the process to invent the particular drug, and while that is probably a little bit more of a true IP case versus a trade secret case, that type of research and development, that type of work isn't necessarily, it could be patentable, but it's not necessarily going to be patented. And that's truly the pertinent definition for a pharmaceutical company, is whether or not you're going to take the next step to publicly announce what your development is and protect it in that way. Basically, there are lots of steps in the process that can constitute a trade secret, such as the results of testing or research and development work like that was done in this particular case. So the big takeaway here is define your relationships with outside sources that are performing R&D. You want to have contracts in place. You want to say who owns the work. And frankly, you want to indicate that you're paying them for their work and their work only, and that they automatically transfer any intellectual property rights to you. Another instance of a R&D-based misappropriation, there are instances in which people are granted, third parties are granted legitimate access to the trade secrets, but then turn around and misuse that information. A prime example is the Rhone Poulenc versus DeKalb case, where DeKalb had licensed certain of Rhone's technology to do research and development work. DeKalb generated positive data, but failed to tell Rhone the results. DeKalb then went on to induce them to divulge more information, and then DeKalb turned around and filed a patent application. As you can see, once again, the money here is pretty substantial, and obviously that's a byproduct of the fact that this is a very lucrative industry. So, you will see instances of trade secret misappropriation where parties go in and they learn about the misappropriation right off the bat. They're able to move for injunctive relief, move to have the information returned, and really able to stop the financial harm well before it gets to the point where someone has patented the work. On the other hand, because this is a very secretive industry, instances like DeKalb or the University of Colorado case, there's many times where you really don't know what happens to the information. It may be a circumstance where 5-10 years down the road you learn of the issue, and then you still have to try and go in, and you just may not be trying to recover the information, but you may be trying to recover the financial damage that you suffered as a byproduct of losing the trade secret. Sorry, we're having a little technical difficulties with our slides here. Moving on to manufacturing-based or manufacturing process-based misappropriation. In the Norbrook Labs case, you had an incident where someone left the company, went to a new company, and then passed along information about the process that was utilized in order to formulate the medication. This particular case involved veterinary penicillin, and there was a very costly two-step process that was being utilized in the industry, where Norbrook had identified a one-step process. This particular employee left in 1992 to go to Hanford and develop the process utilizing information that he had learned at Norbrook Labs in 1999. So the trade secret is not necessarily something that is going to go away within a year, within 2 years. If the process is secret in the industry, that that secrecy can continue on for several years after an employee left. In this particular case, Norbrook was able to acquire or was able to obtain a preliminary injunction based on the evidence that it identified that its former employee had passed along this information. So this is really important for employers who are onboarding employees who previously worked for a competitor. You really want to be particularly careful in your policing activity. It's really not enough for you to say, we don't want your former employer's information in an offer letter or in an agreement, you really need to be careful about what information is being loaded in. If you are aware that your competitor has a particularized process or product, you really want to make sure that the employee is not uploading information, doing things that would be subject to the interpretation of a court to be improper. In addition to those things that are actually more formally part of the process to develop a drug, such as the R&D process or the manufacturing process, trade secrets can also be the R&D, the pre-R&D vision work. So in this particular case, the BYU versus Pfizer, a university professor had a vision plan where he put together a booklet about developing an alternative drug, where the 42 parts of it, of the vision, were all publicly available information. What the court said, though, is that while the information may be publicly available, the compilation of those of that information into effectively a new idea created something that didn't previously exist in the industry, and that was capable of having trade secret protection. This is really important because, you know, many times you may have conversations internally with people at your organization, and they may say, oh, you know, I knew this, or oh, you know, such and such part of this was publicly available, and they may automatically assume that the information that has been collected and put together, therefore, is really not a secret. I can't tell you the number of conversations that I've had with internal business people who really don't truly recognize the fact that the information that they've acquired through their business can be a trade secret. Even if other businesses have collected similar information, it doesn't take away the trade secret protection of the information that you have in your possession. For example, I talked about the downstream commercial chain. You know, just because one pharmacy sells drugs to the same person at different locations, or different pharmacies sell different drugs to the same person, doesn't mean that the identity of the person buying those particular drugs isn't a trade secret to your organization, even though it's potentially available elsewhere. You have collected the information, you have spent time and money developing the information, protecting the information, and you have an ongoing belief that that information is going to be valuable to your organization. That can constitute a trade secret. Next slide, if we get there, is when clinical trial information may be, but is not always, a trade secret. Truly, I think that this particular case, Hoffman-LaRoche v. Yoder, was a case where the protections that were put in place by Hoffman-LaRoche were not sufficient to protect the information. You can protect clinical trial information. That can constitute trade secret information. But as Marcus mentioned earlier, this is really a question of protection. It's really a question of what you have done to protect against that information being disclosed in the industry. In this particular case, the protocols, investigational drug brochures, compendium of correspondence were deemed to be not protectable because the information had been published subsequent to the use of that information, and the company didn't have protections in place to prevent against it. So here, the defendant doctor was a third party who later on, who was involved in the clinical trial process, who later on published the results that he had. He was never required to sign a non-disclosure agreement, and the same literature had been produced, you know, nearly 20 years before. So really the takeaway here is, if you're involving third parties in a clinical trial or any part of the drug manufacturing process, you really want to make sure that they are going to protect that information, that you have a contractual, that they owe a contractual obligation to you to protect that information the same way that you would protect that information. Courts will find that to be a sufficient step to protect the information. That said, if the information is released into the public and steps aren't taken in the near term to get that information withdrawn or protected in some other way, then you can waive the trade secret protection. Here, I think you could probably say clinical trial information would have been deemed a trade secret, but the protections that were taken were not sufficient enough to go to that. Additionally, if, and this is something that was mentioned before, but if something is put in the public sphere, for example, if you patent a production method, then you cannot claim trade secret protection on that as well. However, if you did not patent the production method and you took the steps that were necessary to protect information from being deemed disclosed into the public, then that can constitute a trade secret. So, for example, if you just patent the formulation of Zantac, for example, but not the actual production method, then the production method itself and all the information that goes into putting that production method together can constitute a trade secret, which will last beyond the patent protection that you have on that particular drug. So that's really a question that if you get into this, you get into this process, you want to have an honest conversation with whoever is serving as your in-house or external intellectual property attorney as to what is the best way to protect the business aspect of this for the longest amount of time. Beyond the civil aspect of trade secret protection, there is a criminal side to this as well. That's codified federally under the Economic Espionage Act. And in fact, the Economic Espionage Act is actually what was amended last year to form the Defend Trade Secrets Act. But prior to the Defend Trade Secrets Act, the Economic Espionage Act gave companies effectively almost a second bite of the apple, where they could utilize the FBI and the Justice Department to file lawsuits against ex-employees generally who were being accused of trade secret misappropriation. There's been lots in the news, both in the President Obama's administration and President Trump's administrations, that have talked about the risk of trade secret misappropriation by foreign nationals. Very, very frequently, those lawsuits have been filed against Chinese nationals working here, but that's not—it's not exclusive to them. There was a case several years ago where Eastern European nationals had been accused of stealing windmill technology and were being prosecuted as well. So, I mean, the higher profile cases you can see have been filed against Chinese nationals, and I think that may be prejudicial element of it as much as anything, but that's where the hotbed of these type of lawsuits have been filed. But there are downsides to this, one of which is you lose control of the investigation process. You lose control over the ability to go in and attempt to recover the information right away. You are effectively forfeiting your rights in a lot of respects when you turn this over to the federal government, and those cases can be a little longer in development. And if there is really truly a risk that this has been stolen or passed on, you may be in a position where, you know, criminal penalties against your former employer is not going to be sufficient to really protect against the economic loss that you're going to be suffering. Lastly, from the case law standpoint, we want to touch upon the fact that trade secrets must be protected at trial. In Glaxo versus Nova Farm, a case out of the Eastern District of North Carolina, Nova Farm actually utilized information that was disclosed during trial to come up with its own ANDA application. And the issue there is that the court said, you know, this was disclosed in public. This was now publicly available information, and this was information that anyone was capable of utilizing. And so if you get into a trial issue, into a trial scenario, that there you have to be very judicious in what you present, because anything that is presented and is not covered by non-disclosure obligations is now theoretically in the public sphere. And while you can come, you can enter into protective orders during the discovery stage, those protective orders generally aren't going to apply at trial. Most judges that I've experienced have been very reluctant to continue to protect the trade secret nature of something when they are presented at trial. So that's just something, some food for thought, and maybe something to take into consideration when you actually get into the trial aspect of things. We're going to now talk a little bit about best practices, but before we do, in order to acquire a CLE credit for today's webinar, you will be required to input the following CLE code. That is S as in Sam, 6259. Again, that's S as in Sam, 6259. Now, the best way to protect your trade secrets is really to follow ACE. Audit, create a culture of protection and enforcement. Now, the auditing process really starts at both the beginning of employment of an employee and the end of employment of an employee. What you really want to do is that you want to make sure that when the employees are onboarded, that you are telling them right off the bat in an offer letter, if they're coming from a competitor, that you are not interested in acquiring information from any of their former employees. I generally recommend to clients that if you're putting those kind of letters together, that you say right up front that if the company determines that you have disclosed trade secret information from your former employer, that is grounds for punishment up to and including termination. You want to have your employees sign confidentiality agreements. We generally recommend that those also include non-solicitation or non-competition agreements to the extent that those are appropriate for your particular industry. You want to have checklists at the outset so that your HR personnel who's required to acquire this sort of onboarding documentation are able to check right off that I have, in fact, received this form back. You want to make sure that the people who are involved in the interviewing process have received training ahead of time so that they know that they should not be requesting information about ongoing projects or methodologies or processes that your competitors are utilizing. That type of information can be deemed to be the company's attempt to acquire trade secrets improperly, for which the company can be found liable. It's not just enough, though, to have these type of processes at the outset of the employment relationship. You want to create a culture. And what we really mean by that is there should be at least annual meetings where people are talking about what is confidential information, what steps should be taken, best practices. For example, if you are dealing with third parties who are acquiring access to your confidential information or vice versa, that you're talking to people in the process about what steps are required to protect that information. Additionally, I've seen a number of courts that have had adverse reactions if a document does not include a blurb that the information is confidential or highly confidential or internally confidential. If a document is available within the company as a whole, even if that is not released to the public, it is harder to define that as truly trade secret information. Most courts now are requiring that to be a need to know. So part of that process is making sure that people who are acquiring trade secrets aren't also turning around and passing that along to someone else within the organization who may not be the appropriate person to receive that. And finally, there's questions of enforcement. And really that is, what do you do in a situation in which a trade secret is feared to be released? That doesn't necessarily require that you file a lawsuit right off the bat. Enforcement may be having an exit interview where you tell an employee that they need to return all their information. Any information that's been emailed to a private email account needs to be deleted. They need to turn over any external media devices. It should be asking where they're going, finding out if they are going to a competitor. If they are locked into a non-compete or non-solicitation agreement, it should be requiring and reminding them of the fact that they have these obligations. And if you have determined that they have actually walked out the door with trade secrets, it should be considering filing a lawsuit. mentioned some of these things before about, you know, ensuring what the company considers a confidential, training modules, do's and don'ts. There are a wide variety of ways that you can do this. It can be simply sitting down and having a broad-based discussion where you have someone who is who has that particular area under their expertise or their job responsibilities. It might be HR, it might be IT, it might be internal legal. There's a number of different people who can provide that. In some circumstances, there are web-based training modules out there as to what is confidential. It might be in the HIPAA-related it might be HIPAA-related or otherwise, but there are a variety of ways that you can identify and define what is confidential. And then the other thing that is really important is coming up with protocols and policies internally. It can be an IT policy, or you know, it can be written, or it can just be something that is taught. You know, for example, many companies have gone to or have utilized either past or present just workbooks. You know, they're written workbooks that are locked in lockers, and you may be in a situation where you just need to remind your employees that those need to stay at work. Those shouldn't be copied. Those shouldn't be distributed. At the end of an employment relationship, those are to be turned over. That is a non-tech instance in which substantially important information could walk out the door without you knowing if you don't have secure protocols in place. When people are being let go, you should have a checklist of the things that they turned in. And so if you determine after the fact that something wasn't turned in, you can follow up and have a better understanding as to why that was the case. Lastly, we're going to talk about what to do if you have the rogue or sloppy employee. The rogue employee is really the one who you have reason to believe has either taken a job with a competitor or is really disgruntled and maybe on their way out the door. One thing that I would recommend strongly is if someone has announced they're leaving and they're going to a competitor, and they've tried it and they offer to provide you 2 weeks of time to transition, I'd cut off their internet access right then and there. I would recommend that, you know, that their email access be cut off, that they be available over the next several weeks to answer questions or conduct any meetings that are necessary. But giving them access to email, giving them access to the computer is a recipe for disaster and allows them to potentially email sensitive documents, print sensitive documents, or download sensitive documents. If you can, if you have the capacity and you have the desire as an organization, there are ways to, both low-tech and high-tech ways to limit the ability to access cloud or insert external media devices. I've heard stories of people who have used super glue and glued over the USB ports so that they can't stick in, that someone can't stick in an external media device. The other thing is if you have the software capacity, you may want to consider monitoring access and downloading of files. Or at a minimum, if someone leaves under sensitive situation or sensitive scenario, you may want to take a look at that after the fact. Exit interviews are always always an appropriate way to try to protect against that, including asking the question where someone's going, what their job responsibilities are going to be. If they refuse to answer that question, that might be a red flag to follow up with it a little bit more. And then as we talked about, you really want to make sure that you collect information from them on the way out the door. So what happens if you actually fear that something has been stolen, lost, or breached? The first thing you want to do is you want to collect any and all electronic media devices that you have, and you want to make sure that if you have automatic email or deletion, you want to make sure that's turned off. I had a case for a pharmacy several years ago where they failed to turn off auto deletion, and probably the best evidence of bad acts was gone by the time they actually realized someone had ended up at a competitor. If someone leaves, it may be appropriate to turn off the auto deletion for up to a year if you have a non-compete. You also want to remind employees of their obligations through cease and desist letters, their confidentiality agreements, things along those lines. If you have insurance that covers that type of issue, you want to notify them. And really, as a sort of a learning point, you want to take the time to evaluate company procedures if there is any sort of breach and you're concerned about the ongoing issues that may systemically exist in your organization. Thank you for your time today. We do have a couple questions. If you want to learn more about the current trends and topics in the trade secret arena, we do have an award-winning blog that you can visit at tradesecretslaw.com. That's regularly updated. And quickly, we had a question from Dan. The question was, what about a disclosure's failure to request return or destruction of trade secrets shared with a joint venture partner on NDA or confidentiality provisions? How would a court evaluate a disclosure's failure to fully exercise and enforce its protective rights? It may depend. It really may depend on the relationship. It may depend on if this is a longstanding relationship where there was a generalized understanding between the parties that this would happen and it had happened in the past. But if this was a first-time relationship, the information was not requested to be destroyed. There wasn't a provision in the contract that required it. A court may view that as part of the totality of the circumstances as to whether or not that was sufficient work on your part to protect the trade secret. But, however, if you have a non-disclosure or confidentiality provision that dictates deletion of the information, if there is a known end date to the project, if there's some sort of documentation that says we expect you to comply with all aspects of the contract, those all may outweigh the fact that someone has actually gone forward and received some sort of written documentation that deletion occurred. On behalf of Marcus and Dean and Thomas, we all appreciate your time today. Again, one last time, the CLE code for this webinar is SS6259. You can reach any of us at our email addresses, and we're happy to answer any questions offline. Thank you again.
All right, this concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.